presidential appointee. He'd also been through a confirmation hearing in the U.S. Senate. Such people were not easily dismissed. There had to be a reason. I never have figured that out, especially Trent. Of all the people to sign off on Ryan, why him? Ask him, Fowler suggested as he buttered his pancakes. I have. He danced around the issue like the prima ballerina at the New York Ballet. The president laughed uproariously at that. Christ, woman, don't ever let anybody hear you say that. Robert, we both support the estimable Mr. Trent's choice of sexual preference, but he is a prissy son of a bitch and we both know it. True, Fowler had to agree. So what are you telling me, Elizabeth? It's time for Cabot to put Ryan in his place. How much of this is envy for Ryan's part in the treaty, Elizabeth? Elliot's eyes flared, but the president was looking at his plate. She took a deep breath before speaking and tried to decide if it were a goad or not. Probably not, but the president wasn't the sort to be impressed by emotions in matters like this. Bob, we've been through that. Ryan connected a few ideas that other people had already come up with. He's an intelligence officer, for God's sake. All they do is report what other people do. He's done more than that. Fowler saw where this was going, but it was fun to play games with her. Fine. He's killed people. Is that what's special about him? James goddamned Bond. You even let them execute the ones who... Elizabeth, those terrorists also killed 7 Secret Service agents. My life depends on those people, and it would have been damned ungracious and just plain idiotic of me to commute the sentences of people who killed their colleagues. The president almost frowned at that. So much for strongly held principle, eh, Bob? A voice asked him, but managed to control himself. And now you can't do it at all, or people will say that you failed to do it once out of personal self-interest. You allowed yourself to be trapped and outmaneuvered, she pointed out. She had been goaded after all, Liz decided, and answered in kind. But Fowler wasn't buying. Elizabeth, I may be the only former prosecutor in America who doesn't believe in capital punishment, but we do live in a democracy, and the people support the idea. He looked up from his meal. Those people were terrorists. I can't say I'm happy that I allowed them to be executed, but if anyone deserved it, they did. The time wasn't right to make a statement on that issue. Maybe in my second term. We have to wait for the right case. Politics is the art of the possible. That means one thing at a time, Elizabeth. You know that as well as I do. If you don't do something, you'll wake up and find that Ryan is running CIA for you. He's able, I admit, but he's something from the past. He's the wrong person for the times we live in. God, you're an envious woman, Fowler thought. But we all have our weaknesses. It was time to stop playing with her, though. It wouldn't do to offend her too deeply. What do you have in mind? We can ease him out. I'll think about it. Elizabeth, let's not spoil the day with a discussion like this one, okay? How do you plan to break the news of the treaty terms? Elliot leaned back and sipped at her coffee. She reproached herself for moving too soon and too passionately on this. She disliked Ryan greatly, but Bob was right. It wasn't the time, wasn't the place. She had all the time in the world to make her play, and she knew that she had to do it with skill. A copy of the treaty, I think. Can they read that fast? Fowler laughed. The media was full of such illiterates. You should see the speculation. The lead Times piece was faxed in this morning. They're frantic. They'll eat it up. Besides, I ginned up some cliff notes for them. However you want to do it, the president said as he finished off his sausage. He checked his watch. Timing was everything. There was a 6-hour time difference between Rome and Washington. That meant the treaty could not be signed until 2 in the afternoon at the earliest, so as to catch the morning news shows. But the American people had to be prepped for the news, and that meant that the TV crews had to have the details of the treaty by 3 Eastern Daylight Time in order to absorb everything fully. Liz would break the news at 9, 20 minutes from now, he noted. And you'll be playing up Charlie's part in it? Right. It's only fair that he should get most of the credit. And so much for Ryan's part in the process, Bob Fowler noted without comment. Well, Charlie was the guy who really got it moving, wasn't he? Fowler felt vaguely sorry for Ryan. Though he also thought the DDCI something from the past, he'd learned all that the man had done and was impressed. Arnie Van Dam thought a lot of Ryan also, and Arnie was the best judge of character in the administration. But Elizabeth was his national security advisor, and he could not have her and the DDCI at each other's throats, could he? No, he couldn't. It was that simple. Dazzle them, Elizabeth. Won't be hard. She smiled at him and left. The task proved much harder than he'd expected. Gone thought about asking for help, but decided against it. Part of his aura in the organization was that he worked alone with these things, except for the donkey work, for which he would occasionally require a few strong backs. The bomb-slash-device-slash-pod turned out to be of sturdier construction than he'd expected. Under the strong work lights, he took the time to wash it off with water and found a number of unexplained items. There were screw-in points which were plugged shut with slot bolts. On removing one, he found yet another electrical lead. More surprising, the bomb case was thicker than he'd expected. He'd dismantled an Israeli jamming pod before, but though it had mostly been of aluminum construction, there had been several places where the case had been of fiberglass or plastic, which was transparent to electronic radiation. He'd started on the access hatch, but found it nearly impossible to pry open, and tried to find something easier. But there wasn't anything easier. Now he returned to the hatch, frustrated that several hours of work had led nowhere. Gone sat back and lit a cigarette. "What are you?" he asked the object. It was so much like a bomb, he realized. The heavy case. Why hadn't he realized that it was so damned heavy? Too heavy for a jamming pot. But it couldn't be a bomb, could it? No fuses, no detonator. What he had seen of the inside was electrical wiring and connectors. It had to be some kind of electronic device. He stubbed the cigarette out in the dirt and walked over to his workbench. Gone had a wide variety of tools, one of which was a gasoline-powered rotary saw, useful for cutting steel. It was really a two-man tool, but he decided to use it alone, and to use it on the hatch, which had to be less sturdy than the case itself. He set the cutting depth to 9 millimeters and started the tool, manhandling it onto the hatch. The sound of the saw was dreadful, more so as the diamond edge of the blade bit into the steel, but the weight of the saw was sufficient to keep it from jerking off the bomb, and he slowly worked it down along the edge of the access hatch. It took 20 minutes for him to make the first cut. He stopped the saw and set it aside, then probed the cut with a bit of thin wire. Finally, he told himself. He was through. He'd guessed right. The rest of the bomb case seemed to be 4 centimeters or so, but the hatch was only a quarter of that. Gone was too happy to have accomplished something to ask himself why a jamming pod needed a full centimeter of hardened steel around it. Before starting again, he donned ear protection. His ears were ringing from the abuse of the first cut, and he didn't want a headache to make the job worse than it already was. The special report graphics appeared on all the TV networks within seconds of one another. The network anchors who'd risen early, by the standards of their stint in Rome, that is, to receive their brief from Dr. Elliot, raced to their booths literally breathless and handed over their notes to their respective producers and researchers. "I knew it," Angela Marillis said. "Rick, I told you." "Angie, I owe you lunch, dinner, and maybe breakfast in any restaurant you can name." "I'll hold you to that." The chief researcher chuckled. The bastard could afford it. How do we do this? The producer asked. I'm going to wing it. Give me 2 minutes, and we're flying. Shit, Angie observed quietly to herself. Rick didn't like winging it. He did, however, like scooping the print reporters, and the timing of the event made that a gimme. Take that, New York Times. He sat still only long enough for makeup, then faced the cameras as the network's expert. Some expert, Marilis thought to herself, joined Rick in the anchor booth. 5, the assistant director said. 4, 3, 2, 1. His hand jerked at the anchor. It's real, Rick announced. In 4 hours, the President of the United States, along with the President of the Soviet Union, the King of Saudi Arabia, and the Prime Ministers of Israel and Switzerland, plus the chiefs of 2 major religious groups, will sign a treaty that offers the hope for a complete settlement of the disputed areas of the Middle East. The details of the treaty are stunning. He went on for 3 uninterrupted minutes, speaking rapidly as though to race with his counterparts on the other networks. There has been nothing like this in living memory. Yet another miracle. No, yet another milestone on the road to world peace. Dick? The anchor turned to his expert commentator, a former ambassador to Israel. Rick, I've been reading this for 30 minutes now, and I still don't believe it. Maybe this is a miracle. We sure picked the right place for it. The concessions made by the Israeli government are stunning, but so are the guarantees that America is making to secure the peace. The secrecy of the negotiations is even more impressive. Had these details broken as recently as 2 days ago, the whole thing might have come apart before our eyes. But here and now, Rick, here and now, I believe it. It's real. You said it right. It's real. It's really happening, and in a few hours, we'll see the world change once more. This would never have happened but for the unprecedented cooperation of the Soviet Union, and clearly we owe a vast debt of thanks to the embattled Soviet president, Andrei Narmanov. What do you make of the concession made by all the religious groups? Just incredible. Rick, there have been religious wars in this region for virtually all of recorded history. But we should put in here that the architect of the treaty was the late Dr. Charles Alden. A senior administration official was generous in praise to the man who died only weeks ago, and died in disgrace. What a cruel irony it is that the man who really identified the basic problem in the region as the artificial incompatibility of the religions, all of which began in this one troubled region, that man is not here to see his vision become reality. Alden was apparently the driving force behind this agreement, and one can only hope that history will remember that. Despite the timing and circumstances of his death, it was Dr. Charles Alden of Yale who helped to make this miracle happen. The former ambassador was also a Yalie and a classmate of Charlie Alden. What of the others? The anchor asked. Rick, when something of this magnitude happens, and it's darned rare when it does, there are always a lot of people who play their individual roles, and all of those roles are important. The Vatican Treaty was also the work of Secretary Brent Talbot, ably supported by Undersecretary Scott Adler, who is, by the way, a brilliant diplomatic technician and Talbot's right-hand man. At the same time, it was President Fowler who approved this initiative, who used muscle when that was needed, and who took Charlie's vision forward after his death. No president has ever had the political courage and dazzling vision to stake his political reputation on so wild a gambit. Had we failed on this, one can scarcely imagine the political fallout. But Fowler pulled it off. This is a great day for American diplomacy, a great day for East-West understanding, and perhaps the greatest moment for world peace in all of human history. I couldn't have said it better, Dick. What about the Senate, which has to approve the Vatican Treaty, and also the U.S.-Israeli Bilateral Defense Treaty? The commentator grinned and shook his head in overt amusement. This will go through the United States Senate so fast that the president might smear the printer's ink on the bill. The only thing that can slow this up is the rhetoric you'll hear in the committee room and on the Senate floor. but the cost of stationing American troops. Rick, we have a military for the purpose of preserving the peace. That's their job. And to do that job in this place, America will pay whatever it costs. This isn't a sacrifice for the American taxpayer. It's a privilege, an historic honor to place the seal of American strength on the peace of the world. Rick, this is what America is all about. Of course we'll do it. And that's it for now, Rick said, turning back to camera one. We'll be back in 2.5 hours for live coverage of the signing of the Vatican Treaty. We now return you to New York. This is Rick Cousins reporting to you from the Vatican. Son of a bitch, Ryan breathed. This time, unfortunately, the TV had awakened his wife, who was watching the events on the tube with interest. Jack, how much did you... Kathy stood and went off to make the morning coffee. I mean, you went over there, and you... Honey, I was involved. I can't say how much. Jack knew he ought to have been angry at how credit for the first proposal had been assigned to Walden. But Charlie had been a good guy, even if he had displayed his share of human weaknesses, and Alden had pushed it along when it had needed a push. Besides, he told himself, history will find out a little, as it usually did. The real players knew. He knew. He was used to being in the background, to doing things that others didn't and couldn't know about. He turned to his wife and smiled. And Kathy knew. She'd heard him speculating aloud a few months earlier. Jack didn't know that he murmured to himself when he shaved, and thought he didn't wake her up when he arose so early. But she'd never yet failed to see him off, even if she didn't open her eyes. Kathy liked the way he kissed her, thinking her asleep, and didn't want to spoil it. He was having trouble enough. Jack was hers, and the goodness of the man was no mystery to his wife. It's not fair, the other Dr. Ryan told herself. It was Jack's idea. At least part of it was. How many other things didn't she know? It was a question Carolyn Muller Ryan, M.D., F.A.C.S., rarely asked herself. But she could not pretend that Jack's nightmares weren't real. He had trouble sleeping, was drinking too much, and what sleep he had was littered with things she could never ask about. Part of that frightened her. What had her husband done? What guilt was he carrying? Guilt, Kathy asked herself. Why had she asked herself that? Gone pried the hatch off after 3 hours. He'd had to change a blade on the cutting tool, but the delay had mainly resulted from the fact that he ought to have asked for an extra hand, but been too proud to do so. In any case, it was done, and a pry bar finished the job. The engineer took a work light and looked into the thing. He found yet another mystery. The inside of the device was a metal lattice frame. Titanium, perhaps, he wondered, which held in place a cylindrical mass, secured with heavy bolts. Gone used his work light to look around the cylinder and saw more wires, all connected to the cylinder. He caught the edge of a largish electronic device. Some sort of radar transceiver, he thought. Aha! So it was some sort of... But why, then? Suddenly he knew that he was missing something. Something big. But what? The markings on the cylinder were in Hebrew, and he didn't know that other Semitic language well, and he didn't understand the significance of these markings. The frame which held it, he saw, was partially designed as a shock absorber, and it had worked admirably. The framing was grossly distorted, but the cylinder it held seemed largely intact. Damaged, to be sure, but it had not split. Whatever was inside the cylinder was supposed to be protected against shock. That made it delicate, so that meant it was some sort of delicate electronic device. So he came back to the idea that it was a jamming pod. Gone was too focused to realize that his mind had closed out other options. that his engineer's brain was so fixed on the task at hand that he was ignoring possibilities and the signals that presented them. Whatever it was, however, he had to get it out first. He next selected a wrench and went to work on the bolts, securing the cylinder in place. Fowler sat in a 16th century chair, watching the protocol officers flutter around like pheasants unable to decide whether to walk or fly. People commonly thought that affairs like this one were run smoothly by professional stage managers who planned everything in advance. Fowler knew better. Sure, things were smooth enough when there had been time enough, a few months, to work out all the details. But this affair had been set up with days, not months, of preparation, and the dozen or so protocol officers had scarcely decided who was the boss among themselves. Curiously, it was the Russian and the Swiss officers who were the calmest, and before the American president's eyes, it was they who huddled and worked out a quick alliance, then presented their plan, whatever it was, to the others, which they then put into play. Just like a good football squad, the president smiled to himself. The Vatican representative was too old for a job like this. The guy, a bishop, Fowler thought, maybe a monsignor, was over 60 and suffering from an anxiety attack that might just kill him. Finally, the Russian took him aside for 2 quick minutes. Nods were exchanged and a handshake. Then people started moving as though they had a common purpose. Fowler decided that he'd have to find out the Russian's name. He looked like a real pro. More importantly, it was hugely entertaining to watch, and it relaxed the president at a moment when he needed the relaxation. Finally, only 5 minutes late, and that was a miracle, Fowler thought with a suppressed grin, the various heads of state rose from their chairs, summoned like the members of a wedding party to the nervous mother-in-law-to-be, and told where to stand in line. More perfunctory handshakes were exchanged, along with a few jokes that suffered from the absence of translators. The Saudi king looked cross at the delays. As well he might, Fowler thought. The king probably had other things on his mind. Already there were death threats directed at him. But there was no fear on the man's face, Bob Fowler saw. He might be a humorless man, but he had the bearing and courage, and the class, the president admitted to himself, that went with his title. It had been he who'd first committed to the talks after 2 hours with Ryan. That was too bad, wasn't it? Ryan had filled in for Charlie Alden, taking his assignment on the fly and doing the job as though he'd prepared fully for it. The president frowned to himself at that. He'd allowed himself to forget just how frantic the initial maneuvers had been. Scott Adler in Moscow, Rome, and Jerusalem, and Jack Ryan in Rome and Riyadh. They'd done very well, and neither would ever get much credit. Such were the rules of history, President Fowler concluded. If they'd wanted credit, they ought to have tried for his job. 2 liveried Swiss guards opened the immense bronze doors, revealing the corpulent form of Giovanni Cardinal d'Antonio. The sun-bright TV light surrounded him with a man-made halo that nearly elicited a laugh from the President of the United States of America. The procession into the room began. Whoever had built this thing, Gone thought, knew a thing or two about designing for brute force. It was odd, he thought. Israeli equipment always had a delicacy to it. No, wrong term. The Israelis were clever, efficient, elegant engineers. They made things as strong as they had to be, no more, no less. Even their ad hoc gear showed foresight and meticulous workmanship. But this one was over-engineered to a fairly well. It had been hurriedly designed and assembled. It was almost crude, in fact. He was grateful for that. It made disassembly easier. No one had thought to include a self-destruct device that he'd have to figure out first. The Zionists were getting devilishly clever at that. One such subsystem had nearly killed Gone only 5 months earlier, but there was none here. The bolts holding the cylinder in place were jammed, but still straight, and that meant it was just a matter of having a big enough wrench. He squirted penetrating oil onto each, and after waiting for 15 minutes and 2 cigarettes, he attached the wrench to the first. The initial turns came hard, but soon the bolt allowed itself to be withdrawn. 5 more to go. It would be a long afternoon. The speeches came first. The Pope began, since he was the host, and his rhetoric was surprisingly muted, drawing quiet lessons from Scripture, again focusing on the similarities among the 3 religions present. Earphones gave each of the chiefs of state and religious figures simultaneous translations, which were quite unnecessary, as each of them had a written copy of the various speeches, and the men around the table struggled not to yawn, for speeches were only speeches after all, and politicians have trouble listening to the words of others, even other chiefs of state. Fowler had the most trouble. He'd be going last. He surreptitiously checked his watch, keeping his face blank as he pondered the 90 minutes left to go. It took another 40 minutes, but finally all the bolts came out. Big, heavy, non-corrosive ones. This thing had been built to last, Gohn thought, but that merely worked to his benefit. Now, to get the cylinder out. He took another careful look for possible anti-tamper devices. Caution was the only defense in a job like his, and felt around the inside of the pod. The only thing connected was the radar transceiver. Though there were 3 other plug connections, they were all vacant. In his fatigue, it did not strike Gohn as odd that all 3 were facing him, easily accessible. The cylinder was jammed in place by the telescoped framing, but with the bolts removed, it was just a matter of applying enough force to drag it clear. Andrei Ilyich Narmanov spoke briefly. His statement, Fowler thought, was simple and most dignified, showing remarkable modesty that was sure to elicit comment from the commentators. Gohn set an additional block and tackle on the A-frame. The cylinder, conveniently enough, had a hoist eye built into it. Thankfully, the Israelis didn't like to waste energy any more than he did. The remainder of the pod was less heavy than he expected, but in a minute he had the cylinder hoisted to the point that its friction in its nesting frame was lifting the whole pod. That couldn't last. Gohn sprayed more penetrating oil on the internal frame and waited for gravity to assert itself. But after a minute, his patience wore thin, and he found a gap large enough for a pry bar and started levering the frame away from the cylinder walls, 1 fraction of a millimeter at a time. Inside of 4 minutes, there was a brief shriek of protesting metal, and the pod fell free. Then it was just a matter of pulling on the chain and hoisting the cylinder free. The cylinder was painted green and had its own access hatch, which was not entirely surprising. Gohn identified the type of wrench he needed and began work on the 4 bolts holding it in place. These bolts were tight but yielded quickly to his pressure. Gohn was going faster now, and the excitement that always came near the end of the job took hold, despite the good sense that told him to relax. Finally, it was Fowler's turn. The President of the United States walked to the lectern, a brown leather folder in his hands. His shirt was starched stiff as plywood, and it was already chafing his neck, but he didn't care. This was the moment for which he had prepared his entire life. He looked straight into the camera, his face set in an expression serious but not grave, elated but not yet joyous, proud but not arrogant. He nodded to his peers. "Holy Father, Your Majesty, Mr. President," Fowler began. "Messrs. Prime Minister, and to all the people of our troubled but hopeful world, we have met in this ancient city, a city that has known war and peace for 3,000 years and more, a city from which sprang one of the world's great civilizations, and is today home to a religious faith greater still. We have all come from afar, from deserts and from mountains, from sweeping European plains and from yet another city by a wide river. But unlike many foreigners who have visited this ancient city, we have all come in peace. We come with a single purpose, to bring an end to war and suffering, to bring the blessings of peace to one more troubled part of a world now emerging from a history bathed in blood, but lit by the ideals that set us apart from the animals as a creation in the image of God. He looked down, only to turn pages. Fowler knew how to give a speech. He'd had lots of practice over the previous 30 years, and he delivered this one as confidently as he'd addressed 100 juries, measuring his words and his cadences, adding emotional content that belied his Iceman image, using his voice like a musical instrument, something physical that was subordinate to and part of his intense personal will. This city, this Vatican State, is consecrated to the service of God and man, and today it has fulfilled that purpose better than at any time. For today, my fellow citizens of the world, today we have achieved another part of the dream that all men and women share wherever they may live. With the help of your prayers, through a vision given us so many centuries ago, we have come to see that peace is a better thing than war. A goal worthy of efforts even more mighty, demanding courage far greater than is required for the shedding of human blood. To turn away from war, to turn toward peace, is the measure of our strength. Today, it is my honor and a privilege that all of us share to announce to the world a treaty to put a final end to the discord that has sadly defiled an area holy to us all. With this agreement, there will be a final solution based on justice and faith and the word of God, whom we all know by different names, but who knows each of us. This treaty recognizes the rights of all men and women in the region to security and freedom of religion, to freedom of speech, to the basic dignity enshrined in the knowledge that all of us are God's creations, that each of us is unique, but that we are all equal in his sight. The final hatch came open. Gon closed his eyes and whispered a fatigued prayer of thanks. He'd been at this for hours, skipping his noon meal. He set the hatch down, placing the bolts on the concave surface so that they wouldn't be lost. Ever the engineer, Gon was neat and tidy in everything he did. Inside the hatch was a plastic seal, still tight, he noted with admiration. That was a moisture and weather seal. And that definitely made it a sophisticated electronic device. Gon touched it gently. It wasn't pressurized. He used a small knife to cut the plastic and peeled it carefully aside. He looked for the first time into the cylinder, and it was as though a hand of ice suddenly gripped his heart. He was looking at a distorted sphere of yellow-gray, like dirty bread dough. It was a bomb. At least a self-destruct device. A very powerful one. 50 kilos of high explosive. Gon backed off. A sudden urge to urinate gripped his loins. The engineer fumbled for a smoke and lit it on the third attempt. How had he missed? What? What had he missed? Nothing. He'd been as careful as he always was. The Israelis hadn't killed him yet. Their design engineers were clever, but so was he. Patience, he told himself. He commenced a new examination of the cylinder's exterior. There was the wire, still attached, from the radar device, and 3 additional plug points, all of them empty. What do I know of this thing? Radar transceiver, heavy case, access hatch, explosive sphere wired with... Gon leaned forward again to examine the object. At regular and symmetrical intervals on the sphere were detonators. The wires from them were... It isn't possible. No. It cannot be that. Gon removed the detonators one by one, detaching the wires from each and setting them down on a blanket, slowly and carefully, for detonators were the most twitchy things man made. The high explosive, on the other hand, was so safe to use that you could pinch off a piece and set it on fire to boil water. He used the knife to pry loose the surprisingly hard blocks. There is an ancient legend of Pandora, a woman of mythology given a box. Though told not to open it, she foolishly did so, admitting strife and war and death into our world. Pandora despaired at her deeds until she found, remaining alone in the bottom of the nearly empty box, the spirit of hope. We have seen all too much of war and strife, but now we have finally made use of hope. It has been a long road, a bloody road, a road marked with despair, but it has always been an upward road, because hope is humanity's collective vision of what can, should, and must be, and hope has led us to this point. That ancient legend may have its origin in paganism, but its truth is manifest today. On this day we put war and strife and unnecessary death back into the box. We close the box on conflict, leaving in our possession hope, Pandora's last and most important gift to all humanity. This day is the fulfillment of the dream of all mankind. On this day, we have accepted from the hands of God the gift of peace. Thank you. The president smiled warmly at the cameras and made his way to his chair amid the more than polite applause of his peers. It was time to sign the treaty. The moment was here, and after being the last speaker, Fowler would be the first to sign. The moment came quickly, and J. Robert Fowler became a man of history. He was not going slowly now. He pulled the blocks away, knowing as he did so that he was being reckless and wasteful, but now he knew, thought he knew, what he had in his hands. And there it was, a ball of metal, a shining nickel-plated sphere, not corroded or damaged by its years in the Druze's garden, protected by the plastic seal of the Israeli engineers. It was not a large object, not much larger than a ball that a child might play with. Gon knew what he would do next. He reached his hand all the way into the sundered mass of explosives, extending his fingers to the gleaming nickel surface. Gon's fingertips brushed the ball of metal. It was warm to the touch.
Allahu Akbar.
Chapter 9. Resolve. This is interesting. It's a rather unique opportunity, Ryan agreed. How reliable? How trustworthy? Cabot asked. Ryan smiled at his boss. Sir, that's always the question. You have to remember how the game works. You're never sure of anything. That is, what certainty you have generally takes years to acquire. This game only has a few rules, and nobody ever knows what the score is. In any case, this is a lot more than a defection. His name was Oleg Yuryevich Lelin. Cabot didn't know that yet, and he was a KGB illegal who operated without the shield of diplomatic immunity, and whose cover was that of a representative of a Soviet industrial concern. Lelin rang a string of agents with the code name of Thistle, and he was running it in Japan. This guy is a real field spook. He's got a better net going than the KGB resident in Tokyo, and his best source is right in the Japanese cabinet. And? And he's offering us the use of his network. Is this as important as I'm starting to think it is? The DCI asked his deputy. Boss, we rarely get a chance like this. We've never really run ops in Japan. We lack a sufficient number of Japanese-speaking people, even here on the inside, to translate their documents, and our priorities have always been elsewhere. So just establishing the necessary infrastructure to conduct ops there would take years. but the Russians have been working in Japan since before the Bolsheviks took over. The reason is historical. The Japanese and the Ruskies have fought wars for a long time, and they've always regarded Japan as a strategic rival, as a result of which they placed great emphasis on operations there even before the Japanese technology became so important to them. What he is doing is essentially giving us the Russian business at a bargain price. The inventory, the accounts receivables, the physical plant, everything. It doesn't get much better than this. But what he's asking? The money? So what? That's not a thousandth of a percent of what it's worth to our country, Jack pointed out. It's $1 million a month, Cabot protested. Tax-free. The director of Central Intelligence did not add. Ryan managed not to laugh. So the bastard's greedy, okay? Our trade deficit with Japan is how much at last count? Jack inquired with a raised eyebrow. He's offering us whatever we want for as long as we want it. All we have to do is arrange to pick him up and fly him and his family over whenever it becomes necessary. He doesn't want to retire to Moscow. He's 45, and that's the age when they get antsy. He has to rotate home in 10 years. To what? He's lived in Japan almost continuously for 13 years. He likes affluence. He likes cars and VCRs and not standing in line for potatoes. He likes us. About the only people he doesn't like is the Japanese. He doesn't like them at all. He figures he's not even betraying his country, because he's not giving us anything he isn't feeding them, and part of the deal is that he does nothing against Mother Russia. Fine. I can live with that. Ryan chuckled for a moment. It's capitalism. The man is starting an elite news service, and it's information we can really use. He's charging enough. Sir, it's worth it. The information he can give us will be worth billions in our trade negotiations, and billions in federal taxes as a result. Director, I used to be in the investment business. That's how I made my money. Investment opportunities like this come along about once every 10 years. The Directorate of Operations wants to run with it. I agree. We'd have to be crazy to say no to this guy. His introductory package... Well... You've had a chance to read it, right? The introductory package was the minutes of the last Japanese cabinet meeting, every word, grunt, and hiss. It was highly valuable for psychological analysis, if nothing else. The nature of the exchange in the cabinet meetings could tell American analysts all sorts of things about how their government thought and reached decisions. That was data often inferred, but never confirmed. It was most enlightening, especially what they said about the president. I didn't forward that. No sense getting him annoyed at a time like this. Okay. The operation is approved, Jack. How do we run things like this? The code name we've selected is Musashi. That's the name of a famous samurai dueling master, by the way. The operation will be called Nitaka. We'll use Japanese names for the obvious reason, Jack decided to explain. Though Cabot was bright, he was new to the intelligence trade. In the event of compromise or a leak from our side, we want it to appear that our source is Japanese, not Russian. Those names stay in this building. For outsiders who get led into this, we use a different code name. That one will be computer-generated, and it'll change on a monthly basis. And the real name of the agent? Director, it's your choice. You have the right to know it. I deliberately have not told you to this point because I wanted you to see the whole picture first. Historically, it's evenly split. Some directors want to know, and about the same number do not. It's a principle of intelligence operations that the fewer the number of people who know things, the less likely that there will be any sort of leak. Admiral Greer used to say the first law of intelligence operations is that the likelihood of an operations being burned was proportional to the square of the people in on the details. Your call, sir. Cabot nodded thoughtfully. He decided to temporize. You liked Greer, didn't you? Like a father, sir. After I lost Dad in the plane crash, well, the Admiral sort of adopted me. More like I adopted him, Ryan thought. On Mushashi, you'll probably want to think it through. And if the White House asks to know the details, Cabot asked next. Director, despite what Mushashi thinks, his employers will regard what he is doing as high treason. And that's a capital crime over there. Narmanov is a good guy and all that, but the Soviets have executed 40 people that we know of for espionage. That included Top Hat, Journeyman, and a guy named Tolkachev, all of whom were highly productive agents for us. We tried to do a trade in all three cases, but they were popped before negotiations had a chance to get underway. The appeals process in the Soviet Union is still somewhat abbreviated, Ryan explained. The simple fact, sir, is that if this guy gets burned, he will probably be shot right in the head. That's why we take agent identity so seriously. If we screw up, people die, glasnost notwithstanding. Most presidents understand that. One more thing.
Yes?
He's told us something else. He wants all his reports to be handled physically, not by cable. If we don't agree, he doesn't do business. Okay, technically that's no problem. We've done that before with agents of this caliber. The nature of his information is such that immediacy is not required. There's daily air service to and from Japan via United, Northwest, and even All Nippon Airways straight into Dulles International Airport. But, Cabot's face twisted into a grimace. Yeah. Jack nodded. He doesn't trust our communications security. That scares me.
You don't think?
I don't know. We've had very limited success penetrating Soviet ciphers for the past few years. NSA assumes that they have the same problems with ours. Such assumptions are dangerous. We've had indications before that our signals are not fully secure, but this one comes from a very senior guy. I think we have to take this seriously.
Just how scary could this be?
Terrifying, Jack answered flatly. Director, for obvious reasons, we have numerous communications systems. We have Mercury right downstairs to handle all of our stuff. The rest of the government mainly uses stuff from NSA. Walker and Pelton compromised their systems a long time ago. Now, General Olson over at Fort Meade says they've fixed all that, but for expense reasons, they have not fully adopted the tap dance one-time systems that they've been playing with. We can warn NSA again. I think they'll ignore this warning also, but we have to do it. And on our end, I think it's time to act. For starters, sir, we need to think about a re-examination of Mercury. That was the CIA's own communications nexus, located a few floors below the director's office, and that used its own encrypting systems.
Expensive, Cabot noted seriously. With our budget problems.
Not half as expensive as a systematic compromise of our message traffic is. Director, there is nothing as vital as secure communications links. Without that, it doesn't matter what else we have. Now, we've developed our own one-time system. All we need is authorization of funds to make it go.
Tell me about it.
I haven't been briefed in. Essentially, it's our own version of the tap dance. It's a one-time pad with transpositions stored on Laserdisc CD-ROM. The transpositions are generated from atmospheric radio noise, then super-encrypted with noise from later in the day. Atmospheric noise is pretty random, and by using two separate sets of the noise, and using a computer-generated random algorithm to mix the two, well, the mathematicians say that's as random as it gets. The transpositions are generated by computer and fed onto laser discs in real time. We use a different disc for every day of the year. Each disc is unique, two copies only, one to the station, one in Mercury. No backups. The laser disc reader we use at both ends looks normal, but has a beefed-up laser, and as it reads the transposition codes from the disc, it also burns them right off the plastic. When the disk is used up, or the day ends, and the day will end first, since we're talking billions of characters per disk, the disk is destroyed by baking it in a microwave oven. That takes 2 minutes. It ought to be secure as hell. It can only be compromised at 3 stages. First, when the disks are manufactured. Second, from disk storage here. Third, from disk storage in each station. Compromise of one station does not compromise anyone else. We can't make the disks tamper-proof. We've tried, and it would both cost too much and make them overly vulnerable to accidental damage. The downside of this is that it'll require us to hire and clear about 20 new communications technicians. The system is relatively cumbersome to use, hence the increased number of communicators. The main expense component is here. The field troops we've talked to actually prefer the new system because it's user-friendly. How much to set it up? $50 million. We have to increase the size of Mercury and set up the manufacturing facility. We have the space, but the machinery is expensive. From the time we get the money, we could have it up and running in maybe as little as 3 months. I see your point. It's probably worth doing, but getting the money... With your permission, sir, I could talk to Mr. Trent about it. Cabot stared down at his desk. Okay, feel him out very gently. I'll bring this up with the president when he gets back. I'll trust you on Mushashi. You and who else know his real name? The D.O., Chief of Station Tokyo, and his case officer. The director of operations was Harry Wren, and if he was not quite Cabot's man, he was the man Cabot had picked for the job. Wren was on his way to Europe at the moment. A year ago, Jack had thought the choice a mistake, but Wren was doing well. He'd also picked a superb deputy, actually a pair of them. The famous Ed and Mary Pat Foley, one of whom, Ryan could never decide which, would have been his choice for D.O. Ed was the organization man, and Mary Pat was the cowboy side of the best husband-wife team the agency had ever fielded. Making Mary Pat a senior executive would have been a worldwide first, and probably worth a few votes in Congress. She was pregnant again with her third, but that wasn't expected to slow Supergirl down. The agency had its own daycare center, complete to cipher locks on the doors, a heavily armed response team of security officers, and the best play equipment Jack had ever seen. Sounds good, Jack. I'm sorry I faxed the president as soon as I did. I ought to have waited. No problem, sir. The information was thoroughly laundered. Let me know what Trent thinks about the funding. Yes, sir. Jack left for his office. He was getting good at this, the DDCI told himself. Cabot wasn't all that hard to manage. Gon took his time to think. This was not a time for excitement, not a time for precipitous action. He sat down in the corner of his shop and chain-smoked his cigarettes for several hours, all the time staring at the gleaming metal ball that lay on the dirt floor. How radioactive is it? One part of his brain wondered almost continuously, but it was a little late for that. If that heavy sphere was giving off hard gammas, he was already dead, another part of his brain had already decided. This was a time to think and evaluate. It required a supreme act of will for him to sit still, but he managed it. For the first time in many years, he was ashamed of his education. He had expertise both in electrical and mechanical engineering, but he'd hardly bothered cracking a book about their nuclear equivalent. What possible use could such a thing have had for him, he asked himself on the rare occasions that he'd considered acquiring knowledge in that area. Obviously none. As a result of that, he'd limited himself to broadening and deepening his knowledge in areas of direct interest. Mechanical and electronic fusing systems, electronic countermeasure gear, the physical characteristics of explosives, the capabilities of explosive sensing systems. He was a real expert on this last category of study. He read everything he could find on the instrumentation used in detecting explosives at airports and other areas of interest. Number one, Ghosn told himself on lighting cigarette number 54 of the day. Every book I can find on nuclear materials, their physical and chemical properties, bomb technology, bomb physics, radiological signatures. The Israelis must know the bomb is missing. Since 1973, he thought in amazement. Then why? Of course, the Golan Heights are volcanic in origin. The underlying rock and the soil in which those poor farmers tried to raise their vegetables were largely basaltic, and basalt had a relatively high background radiation count. The bomb was buried 2 or 3 meters in rocky soil, and whatever emissions it gave off were lost in background count. I'm safe, Ghosn realized. Of course. If the weapon were that hot, it would have been better shielded. Praise be to Allah for that. Can I? That was the question, wasn't it? Why not? Ghosn said aloud. Why not? I have all the necessary pieces. Damaged, but... Ghosn stubbed the cigarette out in the dirt next to all the others and rose. His body was racked by coughing. He knew that cigarettes were killing him. More dangerous than that. But they were good for thinking. The engineer lifted the sphere. What to do with it? For the moment, he set it in the corner and covered it with a toolbox. Then he walked out of the building toward his jeep. The drive to headquarters took 15 minutes. I need to see the commander, Ghosn told the chief guard. He is retired for the evening, the guard said. The entire detail was becoming protective of their commander. He'll see me. Ghosn walked right past him and into the building. Kati's quarters were on the second floor. Ghosn went up the steps, past another guard, and pulled open the bedroom door. He heard retching from the adjoining bathroom. Who the devil is it? A cross voice asked. I told you that I didn't want to be disturbed. It's Ghosn. We need to talk. Can't it wait? Kati appeared from the lighted doorway. His face was ashen. It came out as a question, not an order, and that told Ibrahim more than he'd ever known of his commander's condition. Perhaps this would make him feel better. My friend, I need to show you something. I need to show it to you tonight. Ghosn strained to keep his voice level and unexcited. Is it that important? Almost a moan. Yes. Tell me about it. Ghosn just shook his head, tapping his ear as he did so. It's something interesting. That Israeli bomb has some new fusing systems. It nearly killed me. We need to warn our colleagues about it. Bomb? I thought... Kati stopped himself. His face cleared for a moment, and the commander's expression formed a question. Tonight, you say? I'll drive you over myself. Kati's strength of character prevailed. Very well. Let me get my clothes on. Ghosn waited downstairs. The commander and I have to go see about something. Mohammed, the chief guard called, but Ghosn cut him off. I'll take the commander myself. There is no security problem at my shop. But you worry like an old woman. If the Israelis were that clever, you'd already be dead, and the commander with you. It was too dark to see the expression on the guard's face, but Ghosn could feel the rage that radiated toward him from the man, an experienced frontline fighter. We'll see what the commander says. What's the problem now? Kati emerged from the door, tucking his shirt in. I'll drive you myself, Commander. We don't need a security force for this. As you say, Ibrahim. Kati walked to the jeep and got in. Ghosn drove off past some astonished security guards. What exactly is this all about? It's a bomb, after all. Not an electronics pod, the engineer replied. So? We've retrieved scores of the cursed things. What is this all about? It is easier to show you. The engineer drove rapidly, watching the road. If you think I have wasted your time, when we are done, Feel free to end my life. Kati's head turned at that. The thought had already occurred to him, but he was too good a leader for that. Gon might not be the material of a fighter, but he was an expert at what he did. His service to the organization was as valuable as any man's.